said, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. Between his encounter with God at Bethel and his wrestling with a stranger at the Jabbok, Jacob has done well, if not good. In fact, according to Frederick Buechner, far from suffering for his dishonesty early in life, Jacob clearly profited from it. The only price he had to pay was to go away for a while until Esau's anger cooled down. Buechner's conclusion thus far in Jacob's story is that honesty is not a bad policy. That dishonesty is not a bad policy. Not extreme dishonesty, larceny, blackmail, perjury, mind you, he says, but Jacob's kind of dishonesty, which is apt to be your kind and mine. There is no law against taking advantage of somebody else's stupidity, for instance. The world is full of Esau's, of suckers, and there is no need to worry about giving a sucker an even break because the chances are that he will never know what hit him anyway. Only, here Buechner pauses, only what does it all get him? I think, he says, playing us, it can get him a good deal. His policy of dishonesty, where necessary. It can get him the invitation and the promotion. It can get him the job. It can get him the pat on the back and the admiring wink that means so much. And these, in large measure, are what we mean by happiness. Indeed, Jacob has done well, if not good, thus far. But now the time has come for Jacob to turn toward home, where Esau presumably lies in wait. He sends his messengers out, messengers to scout out the situation, and learns that Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. Suddenly, this happy, successful man is terrified because he is facing the possibility of death. His death by his brother's hands, or his brother's death by his hand. All these years of acquisitions and accumulation, all these stories of deceit and trickery, all these decades when the name of God was only mentioned as the cause of his prosperity, none of this avails when you come face to face with death. I am old enough now, to know how it is when you are blessed in your prime, with family and fortune sufficient to more than meet your needs. Old enough to know how the God who made promises to you when you were young and on the run from home, when you were vulnerable in the dark, alone in a certain place, how God becomes another acquisition, an appendage to your life, an afterthought when you consider the long way you have come on your own. Well, you have certainly said table grace and have counted your blessings. Maybe even before you fall asleep at night, you might murmur a little, thank you, thank you. Now, however, because the diagnosis is dire, or the impending fall great, or the future foreclosed by some foreshadowing of your own mortality, even though it feels disingenuous, originally responded conditionally to God's promise, saying, if you will be with me and keep me and give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I can return home in peace, then you shall be my God. Now, Jacob reminds God of God's end of the bargain. You have said, God, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number. Amen. Then, just to cover his bases, Jacob sends his sucker of a brother abroad in the form of waves and waves and waves of presents that are also meant to impress and intimidate. Finally, Jacob takes his wives and maids and children and property across the Jabbok, across the river. Some say putting them ahead of him for cover, but more, I think, because something long suppressed in him knows that he must face this darkness like the last darkness alone. Ella Wiesel writes, mortals must be alone. He writes this of Jacob and of us all. We must be alone to listen, to feel, and even to fight God. For God engages only those who paradoxically are both threatened and protected by solitude. Therefore, Jacob was left alone, and the man wrestled with him until break of day. The Hebrew for man in this sentence is ish, and has caused an immense amount of ink to be spelt in order to dispel the mystery. Was Esau himself, under cloak of darkness, the ish, or Esau's angel, or Jacob's better self? Or was it the God who had promised to be with him and keep him and bring him home? With whom did any of us wrestle alone in the dark at night? Surely with all these, with the ones we have wronged or cheated or lied to, we wrestle. A dialogue imagined that can last all night long, in which we try to convince ourselves that if not in the right, we were justified in our deceit, our bad behavior, our meanness, our lies. When we wrestle with the angels of our adversaries who perhaps disturb our sleep with the offer of a mercy we do not deserve. For we wrestle with our better self, the self we keep resolving to be, even as we wake up to the old self we still are, as the sun rises on another day with no amendment to our character. But what if the ish with whom Jacob wrestled in the dark were the same ish who is with us and keeps us and has promised to bring us home? The ish who assumed our human frailty in the heart of darkness. The ish whose name we know. If we pay attention to what we know about the man Jacob wrestled with until daybreak, we can say three things of the same man with whom we wrestle. First, he comes to us in the darkness not to best us, not to prevail over us, but to engage us in such a way that we are restless until we rest in him. In a sense, he is our enemy, because he is the one we have wronged, the one we have cheated of the life he has our cynical self, the self that has refused to be engaged with him in the daylight, when he has come to us hungry, or homeless, or sick, or as an outcast and alien. Now in the darkness, he has come uninvited, a mystery we cannot grasp, to demand of us our very souls this night. Which is also to say, he is the enemy who is on our side. The side of the human being, we do not have a prayer of being without him. Jesus Christ comes to us and engages us through our restless until we rest in him. Second, in the midst of our wrestling with him and our desperate attempts to get a hold of him, he wounds us and changes us. No doubt before this night, if asked, Jacob would have identified himself as a believer in the God of his grandfather and his father. But if pressed, likely he would have offered some vague generalities to identify which God of the many gods this was. Clearly it was the God who blessed him with all of these wives and maids and children and property. There is no mortal who does not have his own God or gods as the object of his highest desire or trust, or as the basis of his deepest loyalty and commitment. There is no one who is not, to this extent, also a theologian, wrote one of the towering theologians from the last century. Jacob's one and all. I sometimes despair of the theologians that we are. Theologians who leave a service of worship or a Bible study or even a day working on Habitat or a week in Calgary as those who are fundamentally unchanged, untouched. Our previous loyalties to the God of our worldview, momentarily disturbed perhaps, but fundamentally intact. But of those who have wrestled with the God Jacob wrestled with that night, our heart says this God afflicts and irreparably wounds them. Jacob and Esau meet face to face. Jacob says to his brother, "To see your face is like seeing the face of God." I take this to mean that from now on, those of us who strive with God will see in every opponent something more terrible than the face of death. We will see the face of God, the face of love. Vast.